I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Pox Populi. Pox, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Pleasure to speak with you.
I got to know your work just recently, basically. I've known about you because you've done streams with Nick Gilvey, you've been on Millennial, but your work really was recommended to me, I guess, by the fact that you liked something of mine enough to read the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
And I it was my piece against imperialism, and you read the whole thing and commented on it. And I thought, wow, this guy, not only he liked my thing, which recommends you to me. I like people who like my work. What can I say? Yeah. I think it's human nature. Anyway, not only did you like it, but you read it with feeling and you had very good comments on it. And I just thought you were phenomenally articulate. And so anyway, I listened to a couple other streams that you did. There was a stream where you had our friend Gadius on. Unfortunately, the sound quality wasn't very good, but still the content of it was excellent. Great ideas. And you also had a kind of public beef stream with a couple of people, one of whom is Hap a Perspective and then some other sidekick that he has.
Mm. And I thought, I didn't know you caught that one.
But here's the thing. I thought, okay, this is like an acid test. How well can he do like a public bitch fest, right? How classy can he keep it? And I thought you did a fantastic job of it. I thought, okay, there are a lot of people out there who always want to say, no, you should never do this. It's always bad. But I thought you redeemed the whole genre of just going out there and talking about your enemies and taking them down a couple of pegs, because as you put it so nicely, the lion might want to just, sleep in the shade, but eventually the jackals nipping at him are going to get a rouse out of him. And it's entirely appropriate. So I thought you did a really great job on that. And I said, okay, this is a talented guy. So I just wanted to get to know you better and introduce you to my audience. So welcome to the show.
Well, what can I say? Thank you for the kind words. I've been around, doing this sort of public persona, this Pox Populi persona since 2018. It was September of 2018 when I started a YouTube channel. And I knew from the very beginning that I wouldn't get a very large audience because I don't have sort of the computer technical skill to make flashy, eye-catching videos. And I don't really have the budget for it. And then also, up until very recently in my life, I moved around a lot. And so basically what I started doing was just talking into a webcam from my bedroom, very, very old fashioned, like vlogger style videos.
Vintage millennial woe style.
Exactly. Well, I said many times, and he knows this, that he was one of the inspirations for my style. I figured, if he can do these kinds of videos where he's basically with some, more artistic flair and some editing and things like that. But more or less, he's just sitting in a room talking to the camera about the things that are going on. And I thought, well, if that's working for him, it might work for me too. And I don't have to worry about making flashy videos with eye-catching graphics and all that kind of thing, which so many other people were doing and still are doing.
Massively over-edited videos too. I cannot watch Paul Joseph Watson. Are you familiar with this character? I think it was from the 80s on television, Max Headroom, who is sort of this computer-generated, jerky, annoying character. And that's sort of him. So massively over-edited. And his head sort of jerks and bobbles around, and his voice, leaps from one word to the other with no breaths in between. It's kind of a bizarre experience. It's kind of alienating.
That's the YouTube model, is to edit out all pauses, all inhalation, exhalation. Everything is very compressed and very, you know, high key lighting. And I just, you know, it's not me. I used to dabble in all sorts of things as a student, and I was very sort of like a dilettante, and I dabbled in film production. And one of the things I always disliked most about, you know, various film projects that we worked on in my student years was all the occasions where it had to be like just really overdone. I was a minimalist. And so mm-hmm. that kind of just, you know, lent itself to the way I made my videos at the time. But it was also just, yeah, everyone else was doing it. So even if I had the skill and had the ability, I wasn't interested in making, you know, really compressed, eye-catching, flashy videos about what are the, let's see what the crazy left is up today, mm-hmm. is up to today. Let's make a get wrecked feminist video. Mm-hmm. I just felt like everyone was doing that, so why should I even bother? You know, I should try and do something a bit different, at least try to add something different, be a little bit more myself. And so, yeah, it was basically just me talking to a webcam every time live. I would sort of make a scaffolding of notes that I wanted to talk about, but really it was kind of like basically a loose script of ideas, and then I would just kind of improvise. So all those old videos that, you know, if anyone wants to go back and watch, that's me kind of just delivering impromptu confessions, observations, speeches, I guess, presentations, I ended up calling some of them. And that was kind of what I did for the most part. And what was interesting was that it became almost like, it was very, and I knew this, like I said, it was never going to garner a big following, but I kind of liked that because it was a very intimate subscriber base. You know, the people who subscribed, it was the same kind of people leaving comments. It was like, you know, we almost ended up having, you know, almost friendships, and they would recommend books to read and things like that. And that would provide more material for further presentations. And, you know, as I went onto other platforms, it was the same thing. I never really got a very big following, but the following I did have, it was very intimate. And I'd get people sending me messages saying, you know, thank you for what you're doing. You're a calming voice in the world. You're a white pill in the world. Because I never wanted to make, like I said, those let's look and see what the crazy left is up to, or let's make blackpilling content about how, you know, horrible the situation is. I tried to do something a little bit different. And it was also interesting because I ended up, you know, feeling myself more or less getting increasingly red-pilled, taking more steps on this path of discovering, you know, the truth about so many deceptions that we are told. So right. Very early on, I shifted from, you know, thinking, well, it's just the illegal immigration that's a problem. And it's a question of, you know, integration and these newcomers have to adopt our values. Well, very quickly, as I kept, you know, peeling back the layers of all these deceptions and following ideas to their logical conclusions, I realized that that is, in fact, a very weak position. And no, legal immigration is actually worse than the illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. And there's no amount of value adoption that can justify demographic replacement. And as someone who has traveled around Europe and who loves the genuine diversity of the European peoples, if that's important to me, how can I just sit back and say, well, it's okay that they become the minority in their own homelands as long as it happens legally and their replacements adopt values like democracy and drinking Guinness or eating fondue or something, like, you know,
right?
It doesn't cut it. And so that's that was very interesting. I remember thinking to myself on many occasions, I'm making a lot of video presentations, not for like, not about the left. I'm making video presentations for and about, you know, conservatives, civic nationalists, centrists, fence sitters. And a lot of my content was about the shortcomings of civic nationalism, the shortcomings of centrists, and how we actually need to start being brave enough to go a bit further and realize what's at stake. And that kind of happened organically. I didn't really plan on that.
Right. I think one of the great things about TRS when it was coming up in the world in 2014 and 2015 and into 2016 was that you had these intelligent people, some of them very funny, educating themselves in public and bringing other people along in their wake. And it had a quality to it that was infectious because, well, when somebody is educating himself, the open assumption is that he doesn't know enough. And so you're not dealing with somebody who's on his high horse pontificating. You're dealing with somebody who's searching for a better worldview. And that can really engage and draw people in. And then at a certain point, they just sort of froze into, sort of a repetition of white nationalism 1.0. And that started in 2017. They just stopped being interesting at that point. And I do think that there's something enormously valuable about intelligent people just educating themselves in public. And that brings a lot of people along. That's what happened with Millennial Woes. That built an audience for him. With some people, the journey ends, and with others, the journey continues. And I think that you're a great example of somebody who's on a continuing journey. And you put things very well. And I think that you're a voice of reason, and you can lead people along. And that's a very valuable thing. How did you choose the name Pox Populi?
Oh, well, there wasn't much thought into it, really. And I don't know if it's a cringe name. I always knew that it would be kind of cringe. So first and foremost, it's because I simply like alliteration and puns and wordplay. And at the time of 2018, populism was all the rage. Obviously, Trump had won in America. Brexit had happened in Great Britain. And, it seemed like, Lega and Salvini had achieved their success in Italy. So we had Vox making gains, coming up, rising up in Spain. So populism was all the rage. But I also knew that I would be talking about some of the ills, the literal ills of society, of modernity, of modern life, what we now call clown world or global homo. And I was looking, sort of thinking about this populism theme, but also diagnosing problems and looking for solutions, because that was another thing that I wanted to do, was not just complain, but also, sit in front of the camera and talk about solutions. This is what's working for me. This is what has worked for me. This is what could work in the future. Leave a comment and let's talk about this. And so because of my fondness for alliteration, I ended up settling on Pox Populi. So it's a bit of the ills of the world are the pox, and the populi is the populism and the people against the system type, romanticism. But that's really, there's nothing really profound behind it. It was just that.
No, I think it's a good name. And when COVID came along, there was like a whole new level of meaning to pox.
Yes. Yeah, that's so, actually, I went on a bit of a hiatus for about a year. I think I was making videos from, like I said, September of 2018. I went on Millennial in December of 2018. And then like right after Millennial, I wasn't able to take advantage of that. That's another reason why I never really had a big following, because I didn't get a chance to take advantage of being on Millennial in any sort of way. You know, the censorship came in really, really fast around that time as well. You know, it was very soon after that everyone started getting banned off Twitter, and Woz had already been kicked off Twitter. So that was happening. And then, you know, like just people I was following, all these YouTubers and people on Twitter, I was banned even on Twitter several times and never was able to build up a following there. And some of my favorite people were all getting, you know, censored and suspended accounts and everything. And then in my own personal life, I just had a big tumultuous breakup that ended up, you know, really kind of sending everything topsy-turvy. And so I was actually unable to make videos, even if I wanted to, because I didn't have an internet connection for quite some time. And so for about a year, I just wasn't in any place physically, you know, as far as having an internet connection and a stable, stable accommodation, living environment. And then also I didn't feel like I was in any sort of place to be speaking about these issues anymore. I just needed to take a break, focus on getting back on my feet, and then we'll see what happens. And then in 2020, COVID had already happened. The COVID madness had already started to fall upon us. And then there was the Summer of George as well in the United States, which trickled throughout the rest of the world. All these riots and the tearing down of statues and protest movements of, you know, white students, champagne socialists, liberals kneeling and, you know, castigating themselves for the sins that they've committed against Black people because some guy in Minnesota died of a drug overdose, like just complete madness, as we all remember. And I remember thinking, like, this is perfect. this perfectly fits with my nom de plume of Pax Populi. We've got this disease is going around, and the populace is going mad. So I actually, one day, I was, again, like very, very impromptu, very improvised. I was just sitting in my flat. All of this chaos was going around. It was just complete absurdity. And so I opened up my laptop and made a little video kind of welcoming myself back to the scene, because a long time had passed. And I think people were pleasantly surprised to see, hey, he's back, you know, the few subscribers that I had on my YouTube channel.
So what is your sense of the Anglophone movement today? It seems awfully dead to me. Honestly, it seems dead. It seems disintegrated. And I'm just curious to, what your take is on it, because you strike me as a little bit more online than me, a little bit more engaged with the streamers and people like that. And so I'm curious as to how you view this thing of ours.
It's very interesting. My life has always been this way, in that I'm kind of a late bloomer and I'm late to the party. And the moment I get to the party, it seems like the party is winding down and it's no longer the hip place to be. This has happened on so many occasions with so many things that I start to get interested in. And then suddenly it becomes like old hat, or in other occasions, a wave of restrictions or different sort of restrictive policies come about, or the place closes down or something. That, you know, this gym that I had found that I was enjoying or something like that. But often it very happens. So my life is kind of funny in that way. And yeah, like I've only been very recently organizing streams and having interviews with guests and putting together panel shows and things like that. And it's all thanks to being on Telegram. So I've said on other occasions that, you know, Twitter banned me several times. I never was able to build up a following there. YouTube censorship got so intense that it became impossible to build a following on YouTube. But I kind of rose like a phoenix on Telegram, of all places. And I'm really enjoying being on Telegram. And I've, like I said before, my subscriber base were, it was very intimate. We became kind of like friends almost. I'd have people privately messaging me and we'd be talking together, and people having really dark thoughts would talk to me, and I could help them out, get them through that day. And so I really enjoyed being on Telegram, and I suppose it's because of being on Telegram that I've met the people that have, you know, been guests on my streams, and I'm able to have conversations like this one with you. So it's curious, because Telegram is obviously not where the mainstream is at, but it is a place where we can be ourselves and interact and form online communities. And so far it seems to be going okay, you know, knock on wood. People have said that it's like being in a ghetto. I can't entirely disagree, but I would use perhaps less flattering terms. I don't think it's so much being in a ghetto. I think it's being in a parallel online community where we aren't at risk of constant censorship or banning.
Right.
But as far as, so for me, I'm enjoying a bit of growth. I'm enjoying a bit of novelty in making these friends that are coming on to be guests on panel shows that I'm hosting. And, you know, before being on Telegram, that would not have happened at all. That was not on the cards with my video channels. And it was certainly not going to happen thanks to being on Twitter. I did meet some people on Twitter. I did befriend some mutuals on Twitter. But then, you know, a week later, I'd get my account banned and I'd lose all those contacts. So personally, I'm having a good moment. But as far as the wider dissident movement, nationalist movement, whatever you want to call it, in particular, the Anglosphere one, the Anglophone online community, I talked about this in a video I made, I think in 2021. It was a two-part series, and I just called it The State of Nationalism in Current Year. And the first part I called, part one, Stagnation.
I actually watched that. That's the first thing of yours that I watched. Now that I think back on it, that's the first thing of yours that I watched. And it must have been, maybe it was in 2021. I think it was in 2022 that I saw that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just made that video because I feel like the stagnation has continued, but it's not entirely our fault. It's not because we've run out of ideas. I think it's because some things came out of the blue that we didn't expect. And so we weren't able to formulate a unified position on them. And then this, like I said, the censorship has just been so intense. And so we're no longer able to engage with the mainstream. We're kind of having to content ourselves with divisions amongst ourselves and intellectual fencing amongst ourselves, which is great. It definitely sharpens our elbows, but we don't get a chance to then utilize all of that sharpness against our adversaries. It's just sort of left amongst ourselves. And our community was all over the place on some really fundamental issues. And it just felt like we were in a holding pattern. And of course, there were real world restrictions. So we couldn't organize conferences. We couldn't meet up with people. We couldn't have face-to-face interactions like in normal times. And so we were kind of stuck online and arguing the toss about, you know, the whether lockdowns are based because it's the use of state power.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then we had people, you know, sort of on our side mocking the boomers who didn't want to wear masks and all this kind of stuff. And I just thought that was a real shame. And so I felt like making a video trying to encourage the leading voices in particular to formulate a unified position on this and not just, you know, waste time arguing amongst ourselves, because that's not useful. That's not what we were about. And I even again mentioned what was in that video, saying, you know, what happened to the days where we would, you know, crack open the webcam or you know set up the camera and just talk about where we stand on these things. And yeah, I did feel like there was a bit of stagnation, but again, like I said, because of the restrictions in the real world, you know, it wasn't entirely our fault. We couldn't actually go out and speak to each other and organize conferences. And I think there's a theory that people have that part of the past, you know, 2.5 years, there was some motivation. And I think this might be a valid theory. Some of the motivation behind, you know, the lockdowns and the restrictions that were imposed all over was a reaction, a fearful reaction to the rise of populist nationalist politics and people like Trump and things like Brexit. And so a way to quash that was to basically shut down the world. I think there might be something to that.
Yeah, I don't think that's it. I wish they were that afraid of us. I wish they really were that afraid of us, but I just think they were really, really afraid of COVID, of the bird flu or whatever. And that was enough to get people to basically put civilization on hold for the better part of 2 years. So just looking back on things, in 2019, things were going really well, I thought. Certainly from my perch at Countercurrents, things were going really well. Our traffic was excellent. Books were coming out. We had new writers popping up who were really, really good. It was a good time. And then I remember the first day that I really sort of felt the sting of COVID. You know, there was all this talk about it in January and February of 2020. And then I went to a concert, and I knew that this concert was almost sold out because I bought the second to the last ticket. And when I got there, the hall was half empty. And I thought, what's going on here? And then I heard this woman coughing in the row behind me. And I thought, this is what's going on here. And then I said, I'm not going to take any chances. God knows what's going on here. And I just got up and walked out. And I did not attend a music event for almost 2 years, I think, after that. You know, there was a real division, and I think we were on opposite sides on a lot of the COVID related issues, but there was a real rift that opened up in our movement around COVID, and it hasn't. I was hoping that as COVID has faded away, that it would fade away too, and it has to some extent. But I feel like some people have been so wounded by this that they're basically, they've basically been sidelined by it. And it's like, my God, do we just leave the wounded behind and keep going? it just seems horrifying. So we had COVID for almost 2 years. And then just as we were getting out of the COVID stuff, and of course we had BLM, and all that insanity, and the stolen election, all of those were unifying things, but the COVID thing was a divisive thing. We seem to be coming out of COVID, and then we have the war between Russia and Ukraine, which is almost a year ago now. It was February 24th of 2020. And so that was like a 1-2 punch. Two, I think, very divisive things were thrown in. Two apples of discord were thrown into our ranks. And I think it's been really bad. But here's the thing, and this is a peculiar thing, and it's somewhat based, an assessment somewhat based on my viewpoint. I look at traffic statistics, and I see, okay, I see division and stagnation and people falling out and bad feelings and people who can't work together anymore. And I've seen this starting in March of 2020 and intensifying in February of 2022. And it looks like the movement is a mess. I also see people disappearing from the stage of the movement.
Yeah.
People giving up, people going mm-hmm. away. And from the point of view of content consumers out there, it looks like things are shrinking. But I'm looking at objective data about web traffic, and I'm seeing that in 2023, well, in 2022, we had more than three times the traffic that we had back in 2020. We had twice the traffic in 2022 that we had in 2021. So there are a lot of new people coming to our platforms, at least to Countercurrents, but there are fewer people on stage. And so it looks like the movement is shrinking. And I don't know if other platforms experience similar things. There are some people that I talk to. They're sort of collegial and you know I can compare notes with them, but there are other groups that I don't have any real contact with. And so I don't know what their experience is, but it seems to me that there are a lot more people looking at our material, but our internal act is very disorganized, very factionalized, embittered. There are little groupuscules that get along together, but you know, they're very much opposed by other groups and there's a lot of bad blood. And so that makes things look really, really bleak, but objectively more people are still coming to our platforms than before. So I don't know if COVID and the Ukraine war have been all that bad. There have been people who fell out with me over these things, mm-hmm. but for everybody who's fallen out with me over these things, there are probably 100 new people coming to Countercurrents regularly.
Well, you and I, you were on the New Year's stream with American Krogan, Quickyard, and Nick Gilvey. Mm-hmm. You joined fashionably late, but we had been speaking about how 2022 was characterized by division. If we had to characterize 2022 in a word, the word was division, because as you said, the Ukraine-Russia conflict was. It basically, COVID was like a left jab that really got us square on the nose. And then the Ukraine-Russia conflict was like the knockout right hook mm-hmm. as far as just division and breaking the right wing, you know, online movement, online community. Mm-hmm. But I had said that I'm not actually too concerned about it. I think these divisions are probably, in the long run, good. Because if we are, you know, we needed these things to reveal to us that maybe we're not all on the same page on some pretty important questions. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing to be fellow travelers. But then at certain parts, we take different forks in the road. Mm-hmm. And that solidifies who is in your tribe. And like you said, you know, you can get even more traffic and more friends because you have a clear position and that position is one that these people agree with. So they will look to you. And, you know, depending on the friendliness of the parting of the ways, you might not lose those old fellow travelers, you know, and what happens with being online. So we were talking about the Anglophone sphere about this, you know, I would say that there are things that the Anglophone community is doing much better than in continental Europe and even in real life. But certainly online, there's nothing quite like what we have outside of the English-speaking world. And in fact, because I have a kind of, I wouldn't say pan-European, but I have a specific focus on some non-English-speaking countries. So I have mm-hmm. attracted some non-English-speaking followers. And they will also say, like, nothing quite like this exists in Spain. Nothing quite like this exists in Italy, in as far as, you know, an online community of nationalists, dissidents, ethno-nationalists, what have you. And then on top of that, now in the real world, we have printing presses, publishing houses that are publishing, you know, real life, hard copy, physical copies of excellent books. Mm-hmm. I myself try to encourage, and I try to invite on people who are taking real world action and, you know, creating literature, art, music, because I think that all forms part of the parallel system that we need to be creating. We've already kind of got the alternative media, alternative mm-hmm. journalism. We've been doing that for quite some time, and now we're branching out into other areas, and it's actually, it's inspiring, and it's good to see. But I think intellectually is where we see the stagnation, because we've just been arguing amongst ourselves. And
right.
The problem with being online and the problem with online communication is that I just think it encourages nastiness, talking past one another, misrepresentations, mm-hmm. And also just the way that the internet culture has changed language. So now, TLDR, nobody wants to read a lengthy, well thought out commentary with lots of nuance. No, they want the snappy, mimetic one liner that basically, just shuts down the argument, because it's all mm-hmm. about online blood sports, basically. That still hasn't gone away, which sometimes can be useful and entertaining. You mentioned the spat I had. I eventually just couldn't be silent anymore, and I had to, revert back to the old days of blood sports online. But I think that's one of the reasons why there was so much division and falling out and things like that. But ultimately, if someone has the position that, Russia is a based trad country and they want to cleanse the world of global homo degeneracy, and therefore I support their denazification military operation of Ukrainian people. Okay, well, maybe we were just fellow travelers for a while, and
right.
Now it's time to part ways on that issue. And we'll see where the road takes us eventually. But we're not on the same side on that issue, so it's okay.
Right. Yeah, I do think it is a positive thing, actually, ultimately, because I think that fundamental principles influence history. And therefore, when people have debates about principles, or they discover that they have disagreements about concrete political things that are going on in the world because they have different principles, or because one person doesn't have any clear principles at all, I think that's healthy. That's a step forward. That's part of the educational process that I think that we need to be encouraging. We need to get people to think about fundamental principles, reflect on what they actually believe. It's very disappointing to me, though, to see the number of people who don't think in terms of principles. Mm-hmm. There are a number of people whose entire position on the Russia-Ukraine war was just based on partisan tribalism of the lowest sort. All the shit libs on Twitter have Ukraine flags. How can you support Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've heard stupid arguments on that level from otherwise intelligent people. And I just have to say, wait a second, that's not how I orient myself in the world. I don't let my enemies tell me who my friends are.
Mm-hmm.
I make decisions based on principles. And the principal decision as an ethno-nationalist is to support a sovereign state that is being attacked by a multinational, multiracial, anti-nationalist imperial force. That's mm-hmm. what I stand for. And so it was a no-brainer for me for the Russia-Ukraine thing. But there are some people who don't have principles. They just have a head full of memes. You have to admit that Putin had great memes. Mm-hmm. He certainly won the meme war for a long time. And if you don't think in anything other than memes and, say, your orientation towards the people you don't like on Twitter and things like that, I can see how people can arrive at a fundamentally wrong take, a surprising take. The really surprising thing for me are the neo-Nazis who are supporting the denazification of Ukraine. How do they sleep at night? Where do they get off doing this? How is this even possible that these people are doing this? I don't get it, right?
It's the thing is, it's not easy. Like you said, it has to be about principles. And I'm the same way. That's why I read out loud your essay on ethno-nationalism versus imperialism, because this is another one of those issues that we have to talk about. And this is an intellectual movement. This is a salon culture, as it's been referred to. And so, yeah, when the occasion arises and these issues become really important in real life, this is where the online right is actually quite useful, because it is an intellectual movement. It isn't an educational circle of creators and voices and writers and vloggers. And so that's when we kind of come into our own. And it has been disappointing. And this is going back to the damaging effects of internet communication, online communication and memes and things like that, is that, yes, much of Ukraine is distasteful. Much of Ukraine, much of the Ukrainian political class is distasteful. Many of the people putting Ukrainian flags in their Twitter bios are unpleasant. But as a matter of principle, as an ethno-nationalist, I still support the Ukrainian people and their desire to be free of Russian rule. Now, you say something like that online, and immediately you will be accused of being a global homo supporter of Zog.
Right.
And it's like, it doesn't even matter if they know who you are. And it doesn't matter how many years you've been saying, I am not a supporter of global homo Zog. I am quite vocally opposed to it. And I publicly oppose it at risk of my well-being and my safety and my bank account. No, none of that matters. It doesn't matter. You still see people will just, again, go right past any nuance or, decency. And it's just straight to, all right, well, then you enjoy licking global homo's boots then. It's like, wait a second. That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm supporting. I'm saying I support the ethnic peoples of Ukraine and their right to be sovereign. But that's no longer, the internet has done something to the way we communicate with each other, and it's just completely obliterated any nuance, and also it's fomented, snappy one-liner responses, and like you were saying earlier, that sort of those groups of people. Okay, so here's the group of people that are really pro-Russia. Here's the group that's not so much. Here's the group that's trying to take a nuanced take. Okay, it's frustrating. It's annoying. But ultimately, I think if we have to excise some people, it's okay. If we have to say, go your own way, we don't have anything in common as far as these important issues, and that's fine. I think it's kind of like a quality control now at this point. And it is showing who stands by principles and who has principles, and
right,
who is actually, concerned about having some principled stances, and who is just more interested in what I call hot take wankery.
Right. Yeah, I think that is an important phenomenon. The hot take wankers definitely play an important role in, I think, keeping the movement dumb and distracted. It's very, very unfortunate, and I don't know exactly what to do about that. I think it just has to do with the corruption of the people whose minds have been corrupted by fast media.
That's it. Yeah.
By sound bites, by social media, by videos that are edited in a jerky Max Headroom way. And you see Paul Joseph Watson's head bobbling or the latest outrage towards you. And I think that that is sort of that sort of corrupts the way the brain of the brains of a lot of people work. And the other thing is that they're fundamentally motivated by the search for novelty and entertainment.
Yes.
There's a certain outrage pornography that takes place where people are just constantly going. It's like the dog returning to its vomit over and over again. There are people whose minds are so fixated on negative things and yet returning to the source of the negativity over and over and over again.
This is another reason, I can jump in. This is another reason why I have never really, I kind of keep my head down. I keep myself to myself, but even if I wanted a bigger audience, this is kind of the reason why I never obtained it. Because once I give my thoughts on something, whether it's a Substack essay or a video, I hate repeating myself and I hate having to go back to the same topics. It's just like, I already addressed this. There it is. If you want to know what my thoughts are, here's the link. And I don't have anything else to say about it. So often I would go lengthy spells without making any videos. Or I think the last time I wrote an essay on my Substack was in the summer of 2022, because I don't like to demoralize. I don't like to only talk about, whatever is the latest outrage, using the internet meme speak, the current thing now, right? We have the current thing. I don't really enjoy doing that very much. And on the occasions where I have addressed the current thing or I have addressed fundamental value or principle, well then job done. I don't want to keep going back to that. But there's other people who have made quite a name for themselves and are quite successful doing that sort of thing, like constantly a hot take today and then a hot take tomorrow and then a hot take. And they have to have an opinion on everything. There are some things which I just don't have an opinion on because I don't find it very interesting or because I don't know enough to have an opinion. Like I haven't talked too much about the war in Ukraine because I don't know much about Eastern European geopolitics. So I have very little to say on the matter. I have a principled stance and that's about it. I don't really want to talk about it anymore. Go somewhere else. Go to people who are much more qualified to talk about these things, not me.
Or people who are woefully unqualified, but that doesn't stop them talking about it.
And what I've noticed then too is about this hot take wankery culture is that given enough time, because no one's actually principled, a hot take that they came up with, let's say in a couple months ago, well, enough time has passed, now it's time for another hot take. It completely contradicts the hot take that they had 2 months ago, but it's like, the current thing has shifted slightly and now we need to make a hot take about it. And I think this is also provoking a lot of friction and arguing past each other because no one's actually taking positions that are principled and consistent anymore. It's all about hot take. I want to look clever for my audience or whatever. And we're all trying to up the other person on the most obscure angle and the most rarefied hot take possible. And so it ends up being this like, it seems like it's a race to the top, but ultimately it's a race to the bottom because there's a lack of principled positions. And so, yeah, that's why sometimes there would just be very long spells and I'd see people in the comments of my, my YouTube videos, "Hey, you're back. I thought you'd, deactivated your channel or something." It's just like, no, I simply had nothing to say. I don't like repeating myself. And I don't have it, the old adage, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. I'm looking at what's going on and bad things are happening. I don't need to draw attention to that. We all know that these things are happening. I don't have anything to say. I've already said what I needed to say about other things, timeless questions and principles. So there's no reason to go back to that. So I'll just keep shtum.
Right. So one of the things that amuses me in Telegram that I do admit that I watch this current thingery going on without really siding one way or the other is the war between, for lack of a better term, the Thule-tide camp. Mm-hmm. And then I guess it's sort of an overlapping group of people that would include TRS and the NJP and Keith mm-hmm. Woods and Joel Davis, who I guess what they have in common is one thing that they have in common definitely is they think that the growth in populism is going to be from Bernie Sanders voters, which I just think is utterly daft and obviously untrue. The growth in populism is going to be from the kind of people who voted for Donald Trump, not Bernie Sanders. And if you ask yourself what drives their messaging since 2017 in the case of TRS, it's going after Bernie bros or Bernie sisses and trying to woo them over to their NASBOL ideology rather than serious outreach and growth in populism where you go where the people are, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a populist, you go where the people are. You fish where the fish are. And I just think that whole approach is true wankery mm-hmm. and a massive waste of resources and even talent in some of these people's cases. So, I mean, that's one thing they've got in common. But then there's Thule-tide, who does come off as quite the autiste. I mean, he does have the rough edges that are sort of typical of internet autistes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the big divisions is connected with COVID and vaccines and things like that. And I have to say, it's just endlessly amusing to see this, the war going back and forth between these two camps. I don't know what it's producing, but there are fundamental differences of principle that are underlying this war, I think. So it's interesting to contemplate, but I'm seeing more heat than light coming out of all that, frankly.
Well, this was another thing that I talked about in that video about the current state of nationalism those couple of years ago, because that was something I noticed too, in particular from, you know, the Keith Woods type, and Keith Woods in particular, who, you know, he's got quite a following, and he does good work on many things, but the way I described it, and I do maintain that I coined this term first, although my friend Hwikyard caught on to it quickly after, although he might have used a different term. But in that video I made, I described the people on Keith Woods' side, and Keith Woods sort of in particular, I didn't name him specifically, but I described them as being like hipsters, indie music fans who start to resent their favorite indie band the moment it goes mainstream and achieves some mainstream success. And then they'll start saying, oh, that band is a sellout. I don't want anything to do with it. Their music is cringe. And so they will then look for the next even more obscure indie band so that they can impress their indie hipster friends with their esoteric knowledge of the indie music scene. And what I saw coming from, you know, Keith Woods and company was this sort of hipsterism, where now that the normie right, the boomer conservatives, the conservatards, were starting to catch on to some of the things that we've been talking about for years, now suddenly it was as if the indie band had gone mainstream, and these particular characters, these particular voices in the online community felt like it was, you know, being... it was no longer their niche community and their niche indie band. that only they knew about, and it was their little gem, their little precious stone. And I did get a sense of, and this is the term that I believe my friend Whityard coined, intellectual hipsterism. And that, I think, more than anything, has been the reason why this has continued, because there's an air of arrogance coming from a particular side. And in particular, given hindsight, there's some things that they should own up to, or at least just say, okay, we were wrong to, Keith Woods characterized people who protested against lockdowns as anti-lockdown truthers, which was like an anti-vaxxers, schizotards, which is the kind of language you'd expect from blue checks on Twitter. And so I think people were really put off by the tone, not so much the positions. And it has been funny at times. It has been entertaining to see the back and forth, but it hasn't, done any good. Like I said, I would have preferred that the online right nationalist community had a unifying position and we weren't wasting time sniping at one another. You and I had differing positions on this, but I think to the extent that we disagreed, it was respectful. And I think also I could understand your position was let's maintain the focus on, important issues like the demographics issue and white replacement. And my position was always, yes, I agree with that. But now there's this new thing added to the cocktail, to this chemical cocktail that we should address. But yeah, there was that tone of kind of hipsterism, wanting to distance yourselves from the normies who are complaining about, the masks mandates or, and of course, there was the whole conspiracy theory element. I think that people like Keith Woods and the others didn't want to have their reputations sullied by being caught amongst the ranks of legitimate weirdos.
Yeah, legitimate weirdos. Yeah. Here's the thing for me. I don't like conspiracy stuff either. I think it's naive. I've written things about it. I defend people putting forward conspiracies, and I defend the right to offer conspiracy theories. And the idea that it's a canard to offer a quote unquote conspiracy theory is absurd. It's asinine. It's some of the crime think programming of the establishment, right? But by the same token, there are people who put forward genuine nonsense.
Exactly.
And beyond that, I think some of the genuine nonsense is actually an establishment psyop.
Yes.
Because I believe that one of the ways that the establishment wants to hold on to power as its credibility is cratering is just to poison the entire realm of the mind with crankery and insanity so that nobody trusts anything, nobody trusts anybody, nobody believes their own lying eyes anymore, mm-hmm. nobody uses their own head anymore. They talk about patent nonsense like crisis actors and things like that. And when society degenerates to the point where nobody trusts and believes anybody, then what that means is that the people who hold most of the cards, even though their system might be shakier and shakier, they still have all the advantages because you cannot have an opposition that gels mm-hmm. out of these just cranks, these snarling, irrational cranks. And I do think that is a psyop that the establishment is using against the right. This first crystallized for me after September 11th, 2001. Mm-hmm. When September 11th was a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. By that following weekend, NBC and Reuters were reporting polls that 66 and 67% of the U.S. populace that they polled believed that this happened because of our cozy relationship with Israel. That was astonishing. Two-thirds of the public agreed with me on this. because they were using their heads. The following week, the New York Times gave a name, gave a face and a name to this position that was held by 2/3 of the U.S. populace. They went to the compound of William Pierce, white supremacist, and interviewed him about this. It was a conscious, diabolical attempt to take an opinion that 2/3 of the public agreed and marginalize it by putting William Pierce, Pierce's face on it. Now, bless his heart, he was right, and I don't blame him. He didn't do anything wrong. They were the ones who were doing something wrong by trying to take a mainstream opinion and making it marginal. And then I started seeing the 9/11 truth stuff happening, the disappearing airplanes, the thermite, and the arguments that were carried on in this state of truculence and hysteria. And I just thought, this is a psyop, because 9/11 was obviously bad for the establishment, bad for Israel. And everybody saw it at first. And so what do you do when there's so much truth out there? Well, you've got to taint it. You've got to taint it with the stigma of madness. And that's what I saw happening with the 9/11 truth movement. A lot of it seemed to me just a psyop to make something that was obviously good for our side right on the surface of it to be something increasingly marginal and cranky and just smell bad to normies. And I bet now that if you did a poll, you wouldn't get 66 and 67% of normies thinking that 9/11 had anything to do with Israel. And I think that it was a very successful psyop. They went from 2001 getting, you know, the world saw the truth, to America at the beginning in what, March of 2003, cheering on going to war with Iraq. You know, that's an astonishing amount of power that they were that they had to have, you know, to get things turned around that far, 180 degrees from the initial impression. To you know, we better not how to put it. People were thinking maybe we shouldn't outsource our foreign policy to Israel on September 12, 2001. By March of 2003, our foreign policy is entirely being run by Israel, and we're we've launched a war that is still costing us money, and costing us lives, and it's still poisoning the world. The war that was launched then.
Oh, sure.
That's amazing. That's an amazing turn of events. But anyway, part of that, I think, is the conspiracy discourse sphere. I do think part of that is a psyop. They stigmatize conspiracy theories that are obviously, you know, based on fact. So they attack it from both sides. They stigmatize the very idea of conspiracy theories, and they also inject complete rank insanity into the sphere of conspiratorial discourse. It's a pincer movement to try and stop people from basically peeling away the surface and wondering about, you know, what could these Bolsheviks and these bankers have in common, right? Obvious stuff like that has to be stopped, and so they stop it both ways. But here's the thing. As smelly and unwashed and crazy as conspiratorial discourse sounds, this is authentic populism. And if you look at American history, America, before there was an America, populist discourse that led to the revolution was filled with conspiratorial talk. The 19th century was awash with conspiratorial talk. It's just one of the features of American populist politics. And I ultimately support American populism, even in its most smelly and unwashed forms. Right? I'd like to calm these people down and make them a little critical, so they don't get sidetracked by establishment psyops that are being directed at them to confuse them. Yeah, I do want to do that, but this is the sweet sound of populism to me. Internet blood sports is the nastiness that people hated about the online alt-right. This is a recurrence of 19th century American populism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When politics was absolutely vicious in America and where political participation was enormously high.
Mm-hmm.
It was when politics became civil and managed in America that voter participation started cratering, and it cratered for the better part of a century until Donald Trump came gliding down that escalator and he unleashed the forces of populism in America again.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot to say there. I mean, I've observed on multiple occasions how everything is a psyop meme, mind corruption has led to these bickerings and it's definitely, I think there is some truth to the concern that people are going too far and that everything is a psyop, everything is fake and gay. but you know, for me, I'm someone who lives by that old cliche adage of, you know, you can entertain an idea without believing in it. And there's a lot of things that interest me. There's a lot of things that intrigue me. And so I'll, you know, maybe look into it or share some links or whatever, but it's just, I'm entertaining an idea, not necessarily believing in it or taking a strong position. But yeah, I've definitely seen on many occasions where, you know, you can have an opinion on something that's in these conspiratorial circles. And if it's not the exact right conspiracy take, you can have just a swarm of really nasty hyenas barking at you. It's like, you're still blind. You don't know this or you don't know that. And then you start asking them like, well, okay, so what do you believe then? And they present you with this really far out idea. And it's like, well, I think that might be going too far, but you seem really, really convinced. My God.
Yeah.
And then another thing that worries me sometimes is going back to the idea of, you know, the intentional poisoning of good ideas or the association of the truth with someone or something incredibly distasteful. I do wonder if some of these characters online that also seem to have gained some real world influence now, or real world celebrities who like Kanye start going off on certain issues. I wonder sometimes if that also isn't a part of it, because some of the things that are said right at the moment where people are coming to our side, and then all of a sudden here comes this crazy character getting up to all sorts of shenanigans. And then it's like, how easy is it then for the system, for the mainstream media, to associate the true things with this clown character, this distasteful character? There's a few names that I could mention, but I don't want to, you know.
Yeah.
Pause.
No,
any...
I agree with that. Here's the thing: if such people didn't come forward of their own volition, they would have to be invented,
mm-hmm.
and they would be invented. I tend to think that what you've got are just entrepreneurial cranks who smell something in the wind and they try and get out ahead of it. And that's generally the case. But yeah, I would go so far as to say that if these people didn't come along to create a circus atmosphere, somebody like them would be invented mm-hmm. to create a circus atmosphere, because that's what I would do. If I were running the show, if I were trying to suppress dissident thought, that's exactly how I would do it. And that's what I posited the New York Times was doing by going to interview William Pierce about an opinion held by 2/3 of the populace. That was a conscious attempt to put a negative face on a widespread mainstream opinion. So, and there's no question that there is fake opposition.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. And how many levels of fake there are, we'll probably never know until we go through the archives like they did after the fall of the Soviet Union. Eventually, some of our people will go through the archives of the big three media and the deep state and things like that, and we'll find out how many levels of fake there really were. But there is a fake opposition. There's no question about it. One thing I do want to talk about is the political hipster thing, because I do think that's a great concept. I do think that it explains a lot of the behavior that people have. They're a clique. They think of themselves as better than other people. And they love to pour scorn on normie conservative types. Mm-hmm. I think that a very good piece recently by Nicholas Gilvey deals with this. And he says, look, it's all well and good to pour scorn on the misleaders of the conservative movement, the opinion leaders, the politicos, who are there largely to capture and grift off and waste dissident energy. It's okay to hate those people. They're despicable. What it's not okay to do is to hate on the people that they are deceiving, the people who are waking up, the people who are red pilling in front of our eyes, and you treat them like they're just indistinguishable from establishment operatives. The whole gas stove thing was really quite hilarious to me. There are a lot of different ways that people red pill, right? With some, it's when they want to come for your guns. With others, it's when they want to vaccinate your kids for a disease that doesn't affect children. And with others, it's taking away your gas stove. There are many, many straws that will break the camel's back, and mocking that concern on the part of people in the process of red pilling and radicalizing, as if they are nothing but cringe political operators for GOP Inc., is just tone deaf and self-defeating in the extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I'm a college dropout, so I understand that this is a very intellectual sphere, but I don't forget who I am and where I come from. And so for me, you know, sometimes I just want to take a baton and bash the online right and say, look, sometimes it's okay to have fun. Sometimes it's okay to get outside of intellectualization and, you know, this sort of intellectual hipsterism, and actually rub shoulders with people and see how many of your ideas stick with people. Because ultimately, we can't just be a cloistered group of hoity-toity people. You know, that's kind of also what we are up against. You know, it's gradients of elitism. The quote-unquote elites look down on us like a bunch of pawns and cattle, sometimes rightfully so, I suppose. And then we, in turn, look down on people who could be our allies as also just, you know, mindless pawns and cattle. And yes, I think many of us have been demoralized over the past 2.5 years, looking at our fellow man and how compliant he was, and his lack of curiosity. But you know, for other people in other parts of the world, maybe there was quite a lot of non-compliance and civil disobedience, and people catching on very quickly to what was really going on. I do find it a bit annoying sometimes that, again, I think it's a symptom of being on the internet a lot. And so I do like it in my chat group on Telegram. I'll have people saying, hey, I talked to someone at my work, or, you know, I've got a lot of followers in Ireland who are engaging with these real world protests and blockades, trying to stop the, you know, the ethnic cleansing of the Gaelic peoples in Ireland. And I've got people in my chat going to those protests and talking to people and it's fantastic. And yeah, okay, we all know that there are normies and they're not quite where we are, but that doesn't make them bad people. And in my case, also, like I said, I remember where I come from. When I started making videos in 2018, there were some things that I still hadn't been red-pilled about.
Absolutely.
In particular, you know, the JQ, which is the biggest issue on our side, right? That's how you have your street cred, is if you're woke on the JQ. Well, when I started, that wasn't really something I had any opinion on. I wasn't entirely knowledgeable about it. But because of, like I said, that sort of intimate fellowship I had, right? People were saying, look into this, read this book. And because I like to follow the truth wherever it leads, within a matter of months, yeah, I was pretty understanding of the situation. And then I simply had to get over my feelings of the taboo and realize, okay, it's okay to talk about this. It's okay to ask these questions. It's okay to notice. But that was after I had already made a public persona talking about these issues. Like I said, I've learned things along the way. And so just thinking about myself and then projecting that onto others, I have to believe that the normies can join amongst us, because it happened to me. And I have in turn red-pilled people in my personal life. And so I don't like the hipsterism. I don't like the arrogance. I don't like the cloistering away because, oh, now there's too many normies agreeing with us. Like, for me, that's fantastic. When, you know, to use the indie band analogy, yeah. Whenever a band that I followed, you know, cause I never, when I was in high school, everyone was listening to rap music and things like that. And I was one of the few white kids who listened to rock. And I did, you know, I did get into the indie music scene, and I liked some indie bands that were obscure and they were never going to get any mainstream attention. But on the rare occasion that one of my favorite bands did suddenly, you know, sign a major record label, or their song was used in a car advertisement or something, I was happy. I was like, hey, I know that song. I know that band. Oh, it's great. Good for them. They're getting some exposure. Great. So in the same context, when I see more people starting to, hey, all these bankers have something in common, or all these wars in the Middle East have something in common. Someone's benefiting. Right. I wonder about this. Oh, great. Well, come join the conversation. I think that's great. I'm not put off by that at all. I don't think this is here come the normies ruining everything. It's such an adolescent way of looking at things.
And it's self-defeating, because we want the normies to come along our way. And because everybody in this movement was at one time or another more or less intellectually a normie. Now, some of us were maybe sort of thinkers outside the box, less conventional than others, which is why we got here sooner than others. But still, I had a lot of beliefs that were, when I look back on them now, unenlightened, normie, conservative, or libertarian views. Mm-hmm. That's just the way things are. People aren't born like us, like we are now. People come to our views over time, like we came to our views over mm-hmm. time. And to disdain the people who haven't come there yet, well, that just indicates to me that your primary motivation is social. It's cliquishness. Mm-hmm. It's trying to posture as superior to other people, to come up with some pretext for posturing as superior to other people, which just bespeaks a great deal of personal insecurity. I don't think that these people are terribly intellectual. And this is going to sound terribly arrogant. I fully admit that it sounds terribly arrogant. Because if these people were seriously intellectual, why have none of them commented on the White Nationalist Manifesto that I wrote and published at the end of 2018? I put a lot of effort into making, I thought, a very distilled and tightly argued and accessible case for white nationalism. And then vast swaths of the movement have pretended like it doesn't exist. Now, whatever they are up to, I cannot conclude that they are serious about fundamental ideas and think that having the right ideas might be of an advantage in fighting this battle, because if they did think seriously about ideas, they would have at least taken a peek at it. You know, they mm-hmm. might not have appraised it. Maybe they could have criticized it even. But as far as vast swaths of the movement were concerned, it was simply ignored. I just think that that is scandalous. Personally, I think it's scandalous. Who am I writing for? Well, obviously not these people, mm-hmm. right?
That was a criticism leveled against Keith Woods, who we mentioned earlier, is that, and he's got better at this. He's made a few very good videos. Again, I say very good. I don't actually watch much of Keith Woods, because even when he's presenting on some of the most interesting topics, his delivery just, it puts me to sleep.
It's very dull. He did do a few things on nationalism.
Exactly. That's where I was going, is that he was criticized, deservedly so, because he had cloistered himself off in this intellectual hipsterism. And particularly Irishmen were saying, you know, when was the last time you've actually cared about your fellow Irishmen and the things that are going on and the demographics issue? You know, you just make videos about Nietzsche for an hour and a half, for these long, you know, philosophical presentations, but, you know, to the extent that you've been talking about your countrymen, your kin, it's been usually to mock them because they were protesting lockdowns or vaccine mandates or something. And as COVID is waning and the restrictions are being lifted, it's been good to see Keith. I think he's made two videos now about the demographic situation in Ireland and what is happening to Irish people, and the diabolical plans that the Irish government has for the nation of Ireland. And they were very well received. I mean, Keith's fan base loves him. So his work was very well received. I personally haven't watched much of those videos because, like I said, I just find the delivery very wooden. But that's his style, or that's who he is. So I can't say anything other than that. But that was one of the criticism leveled against him was, do you actually care about nationalism anymore? Or is it just, you know, like I said, hot take wankery, intellectual hipsterism? Which I think is something that, again, being online too much can cause that trap. You have to talk to people. You have to look outside and see what's happening. What do people care about? What are their struggles? And find ways to introduce them to our solutions. Because that's another thing that I think is really important, is that we have to offer solutions. We can't just complain all the time.
Right.
And even if solutions are, not exactly optimal, solutions like, improve your personal health. You realize now that there's a lot of deception in the fields of nutrition and medicine and pharmacology. Okay, well, take steps to detach from that and improve your health. Take control of your health. Okay, that's one small thing that you can do, but it's a start. It's a solution to a specific problem of, you know, the additives that they're putting in the foods and in the food we consume. Okay. Now, is that going to topple Zog? No, but it's a start. It's something. And so that's another thing that I try to do, is like, I'm kind of all over the place in the things that I talk about. And so, occasionally I'll talk about fitness and nutrition and try to offer solutions if I can. Or allow people in my Telegram channel, in the chat group, in the comment section, to offer their solutions, their perspectives, their expertise even, because we do have experts in our community who deserve to be heard. Rather than just, all right, well, here's another 2-hour long video on some obscure take on Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very valuable. I do think, though, that there is a kind of negative thing, which is the nationalist adjacent lifestyle blogger. Now, the person who does this beautifully, and I have no criticisms of him, is the Golden One. I think he's a fine person. I like what he does. I don't get some of these other people, and you don't have to go too far before you're just looking at people like Bronze Age Pervert who think that they're going to save the West with beefcake photos and baby talk. It's just, it's, as the kids say, cringe. You know, I, but you can do that. You can do the lifestyle blogger thing really well, or you can do it badly. And of course, with most things in this world, it's more bad than good. But I would love to have more people talking about positive things in it, that they can do for their lives in a good way. That's not just, you know, preening on Instagram and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's one of the, lately the thing has been to record yourself eating like raw liver and, you know, there's all sorts of grifters and liars who will, you know, film themselves taking a bite of raw liver and then the video cuts because of course they spat it out.
Right.
And then, you know, they call themselves the truth seekers and all this kind of stuff that kind of like we're talking about earlier, that kind of conspiratorial community. And there's been some occasions where some of the most prominent figures in the, you know, I suppose alternative lifestyle, alternative health, alternative nutrition. And when I say alternative, I mean to the mainstream, to the, you know, the classic food pyramid model. Mm-hmm. Well, they've been exposed as being complete liars, like taking steroids and
right,
you know, taking a long list of chemical concoctions and not at all being you know, ancestral or wholesome in any way. And it just, yeah, it's again, does a disservice to whatever positive advances were being done on that front.
So you are of American birth, you're an American citizen. Mm-hmm. You are of Italian and Irish descent, mm-hmm. I understand. And you have spent most of your adult life living in Europe. Can you talk a bit about your experience and how that has played into your red pilling, your political views?
Yeah. So growing up in the Midwest of America, that's where I was born. My Irish side comes from my mother, and my Irish forefathers came to America in the late 19th century to work in the copper mines of Michigan. And then my father came over to the United States in the 1980s. So my upbringing was conservative, religious. My father's side is all Catholic. My mother's side, Protestant. My parents themselves ended up becoming a sort of like evangelicals, I suppose. And then because I had, you know, I had a connection with my Italian side, my grandmother would come to visit us. We weren't the wealthiest family, but on occasions, on two occasions when I was a child, we did manage to go to Italy on vacation to go see the family there. And then also, with varying degrees of frequency, my Italian grandmother would send us parcels full of goodies from Italy. And, you know, it was just, it was a part of me that no one else had, you know, no one in my social circle had. I was this person that had this other half, this other side of life, you know, these clothes that the other kids weren't getting because these clothes came from an ocean away. The food that my grandmother would send us, the smells, the different smells. It was like being transported to a different world when these packages would arrive with just, you know, this was at a time when, you know, things weren't so samey, so globalized, so homogenized. There was a particularly Italian way of dressing. There was a particular Italian way of carrying oneself. And so when my family would come to visit, and they're all speaking in Italian as well, very few of my family members speak English. And so it was very thrilling to have contact with that. And then also, I think this has to do with blood memory, genetic memory, because as far as my Irish side goes, for since I can remember being very small, I've always loved Irish folk music, Irish fairy tales. I've loved, you know, ancient history, medieval history, Celtic history. And so I would listen to Celtic music and just close my eyes and have visions of places I'd never been and people I'd never seen, but they'd be playing out in my mind's eye, you know, these vistas of green hills and misty pastures, misty forests and things like that. And so that was how I kind of kept myself entertained as a young boy, was through my imagination, which was very much inspired by my my Celtic side. And so when I turned 18, I got my Italian nationality, my Italian citizenship sorted. I it was very easy. Italy, like most European countries, citizenship is based on blood. It's something you inherit. It's not because you were born on the soil of an arbitrary place on a map. It's something you inherit from your kin. And so for me, it was just a question of going to the embassy and saying, this is my father. Can I get my Italian citizenship, please? And it was all taken care of. And so I moved to Italy and spent a few years there. And then life kind of took me in various directions. I always wanted to travel throughout Europe and see more of it. And I consider myself fortunate to have done it when I did, because this would be starting around like 2008. And, you know, the damage was already being done. The damage had already preceded me. But in the years since, it's only gotten worse. And I was able to see two very important things. I was able to see what I wanted to see, you know, the beauty, the genuine diversity of the European peoples. I was able to learn languages, immerse myself in the various cultures of the places that I went. But then I was also able to see the threat that it was under. And I was able to see with my own eyes how, as the years passed, and in particular, every major urban location that I went to, there was just an increasingly non-European presence, and not even non-European, non-local presence, right? These French cities had a lack of French people. There were whole areas where it was like you were walking through a bazaar in Arabia, or you were walking through Little Turkey. No French people in these parts. On occasions, I'd be on the metro or the tram, and lots of Arabs, lots of Sub-Saharan Africans, lots of Asians, but very few native French or Italian. And so, because these things mattered to me, because growing up, places like Italy and people like the Italians mattered to me. And because I loved the genuine diversity, I loved hearing their different language. I loved learning their language, my language, the language of my fathers, literally. And then, you know, when I go to Ireland, I want to see Irish people. I want to feel and immerse myself in Irish culture, the music, the folk music that I grew up listening to as a kid, closing my eyes and seeing those vistas. I don't want to go to an Ireland that is quote unquote diverse in the definition of, you know, the globalists. I don't want to go to an Ireland that isn't Irish, or that is sort of Irish because, you know, the Africans are drinking Guinness. And no, that's not Irish. That's simulacra. And so for me, it was just a question of recognizing the threat that these things are under and then doing something about it to the extent that I can. And so that's kind of what inspired me to join in this community and give my perspective, because I did grow up in the United States. I've seen I saw what happened there. I lived through what happened in large parts of America as far as demography is concerned, and the plight of white Americans. And, you know, in some respects, America is well beyond Europe. Europe is following the American trajectory. And so I can warn Europeans, and I've done this on many occasions, when things like the Summer of George happen, and Europeans who have never been to America or they don't understand racial dynamics in the United States, and they see that and they think, oh, you know, what? That's terrible. Did you see what happened? Well, they've got the television, you know, the mainstream news is on the television. And because I'm, you know, born in America, they'll ask, well, what do you think about? Did you hear about this? Or, and then I'll simply say, look, what you've seen on television is not an accurate representation, not only of what happened in that particular case, but also you have no idea what the racial dynamics are like in America. You've never had to grow up in a, you know, racially diverse neighborhood or community. You live amongst other Spanish people in your Spanish town. You live amongst other Italians in your Italian village. You don't really know what it's like to live in these places in America where, you know, it's just racially, demographically discombobulated. And in particular, with the African-American population and the levels of crime and delinquency, you don't have to worry about that, or you haven't had to worry about that. And so I'd say things like, but you've never heard or seen any of the stories of the horrific violence that Black Americans inflict on whites. You've never seen any of the white victims of the police in America. You've never heard stories of on Spanish television, right? The Spanish television isn't reporting on any of the massive amounts of Black on Black crime in places like Minneapolis or Chicago. You're just being presented a narrative, a sad sob story that has been artificially boosted by the world's media. And so I can talk to Europeans about that and say, and if you keep your borders open, if you keep allowing these rubber dinghies to arrive, these NGO boats to unload their human cargo, you keep being these sort of champagne socialists, liberals, open arms, open borders, let's take in the refugees. Your communities, your towns and villages are going to become exactly what you've been seeing coming from America, from, you know, on your television. And then it will be too late. It'll be too late. Now, that isn't to say that all of America is like a, you know, racially discombobulated ghetto, like, you know, the cities I've mentioned. But in comparison, the demography in America is quite bad to that of Europe. Europe is accelerating. It's very quickly becoming similar to America. But America is already there and has been for a long time. And so I think Europeans can learn from the errors in America, or the willful, you know, destruction of America. And then there's things that Europeans can learn from America that are good. So I've had many conversations in various European countries about how awful self-defense laws here are. And, you know, a lot of Europeans might crack a few jokes about, you know, America, you know, the rugged individual American with his guns and all that kind of stuff. And that can be funny in the context of banter, but whenever the context was serious, I would say, well, you know, sometimes a little bit of individualism, a little bit of, you know, F the government sentiment is okay, is appropriate, and is actually positive. And as far as owning guns, well, again, that's a chance for me to talk about demography, which I'm not afraid to talk about these things. I've lost a few friends. I've maybe garnered a bad reputation, but I would say, you know, in a lot of cases, it's not the guns in America that are the problem. It's the people. It's the demography of certain groups who are using them. And in other demographic groups, in fact, it's actually not a problem at all. An armed society is a polite society for them, you know, for, you know, rural white communities in America. That you see the same levels of gun violence that you would in you know, in Switzerland. So yeah, I have a mix of perspectives and experiences, that, and that's kind of also why I felt confident enough all those years ago to start the YouTube channel, because I thought I can give a voice to different issues and different struggles and kind of unite through my perspectives what's going on in various European countries, particularly Italy, Spain, and of course the English-speaking countries, and then also uniting the North American scene as well, which has kind of been the, that's kind of why my channel is often a bit, you know, all over the place, but that's because I do like to cast an eye over those places and talk about things going on there.
Well, we have been going for an hour and 40 minutes. I don't want to stretch the patience of our listeners, their attention spans too much. So let's try and wrap up. How do people follow your work? You mentioned Substack. You're on Telegram. Are you on other platforms? How do people follow your work?
Yeah, so Telegram is where I am most active. It's where I'll share links to whatever catches my eye and I think is worth sharing. It's where I will opine about things that I feel I can have an opinion on. Like I said, you know, I'm not a geopolitics expert, so I don't opine too much about Russia and Ukraine, for example, but other things.
None of those geopolitics experts are actually geopolitics
experts. Yeah, it's probably true. But yeah, so Telegram is like my main stomping ground. And then I do a live stream, usually on Thursdays on Telegram. And again, it's meant to be kind of cozy, and we're not talking too much about the various bad things that have happened during the week. It's usually I tell stories, and lately I've been reading passages from Mine War of Trouble, which is a nationalist firsthand account from a nationalist perspective of the Spanish Civil War. And then we just talk about that, and I answer some questions, and then I'll upload those recordings to Odyssey. So I'm on Odyssey as well. If the live stream I'm planning on doing, if I'm having a panel discussion, and I'm pretty sure that will be okay with YouTube's regulations, then I'll also still upload to my YouTube channel as well. So I'm still on YouTube. Just I don't make videos very often. I don't really use that platform very much because I don't like using a platform that has been so antagonistic towards us. And then I'm also on Odyssey if people want to catch uploads of, you know, video content or audio recording content. The Substack, I started that last year. I wrote a handful, quite a few essays actually, articles and things like that. And then, like I said, I just felt like, okay, I think I've said everything I want to say here. So I haven't gone back to writing anything there for some time, but sometimes I do feel the itch to write something. Lately, what's been happening is that I will just contact some of the friends I've met on Telegram and we'll have a live stream conversation instead. But yeah, those would be the four places: videos, YouTube and Odyssey, long articles are on Substack, and then Telegram is where everything is sort of centralized.
That's great. I really have enjoyed this. I'm glad to start getting to know you better. I think you're a very talented person. I think you have great ideas, and I think you're really remarkably articulate. It's very, very impressive just listening to how you can tell stories or give an analysis, an impromptu analysis of something. So I think you're quite worth following. So I hope some of my listeners out there will seek you out. I think it's definitely worthwhile. So are there some final words you'd like to say just about your work or your ideas or where this is all going to end on a positive note?
Well, I would say it's been a great pleasure talking to you in person, one-on-one. Like I said, we were both guests on a panel discussion not too long ago. But it's been great talking to you because you and I are on the same page on something that for me is very important, in particular because I do try to at least find some sort of positive vision for myself, for this community. And I think it was just sort of happy coincidence that you wrote that essay about ethno-nationalism against imperialism, because that was something that I've been talking about for many weeks on my Telegram streams. Even the idea of, we've been talking about the legitimacy of secessionism movements, independence movements, and why right-wing nationalists, ethno-nationalists like myself and like people who might be following my channel, why that's a stage that we should enter, and we shouldn't just leave it for, you know, the subversive leftist types like the SNP or, you know, the Soros orchestrated right. independence movements in Catalonia.
Absolutely. One thing you did say in your stream about my article that I took issue with is that you said that you believe that you were going further than me or in a different direction because you were supporting secessionist movements. And the only reason I took issue with that is because I have been for a long time a big advocate of talking about secession. Even before I started Countercurrents, I was editing the Occidental Quarterly.
I said that then out of ignorance. I wasn't aware. So yeah, we're on the same page.
I just wanted to correct that because when I was editing the Occidental Quarterly, I wanted to talk about secession as a topic in political philosophy and as a practical way of undoing diversity and globalization.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
On one level, you know, it's not the only solution, but it's definitely a partial solution. I was very influenced in this by Donald Livingston, who's a professor of philosophy at Emory University, a scholar of Hume, and a political philosopher who runs the Abbeville Institute, which is a institute about the Southern tradition in America. And so secession is dear to their hearts. Anyway, when I started talking about secession within the white nationalist sphere, and it was a pretty rarefied and intellectual stratum of the white nationalist sphere in America, there was a lot of eye rolling going on. Mm-hmm. They just thought, oh, this is just dead. It's a political dead issue. Maybe it's theoretically interesting, but it's not a way forward. Now, that idea of secession has gone from the margins of the white nationalist movement to the mainstream of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. More Republicans than ever are thinking in terms of national divorce, breaking up the country, thinking that their values and their way of life and implicitly their people mm-hmm. would be better off if their state or their region were independent from the Washington regime. I think that's very, very positive.
It's fantastic.
So, yeah, I supported people reading Harold Covington's books on the Northwest front in the Northwest Imperative. I stood up for the Scottish independence movement. Mm-hmm. I stood up for the Catalonian independence movement, Brexit, Cal exit. Mm-hmm. I think all of these are wonderful opportunities because what we want to be able to do is point to instances where different peoples who are joined together in the same political system can shake hands and part ways without mm-hmm. bloodshed, like what happened with the Czechs and the Slovaks, the Velvet mm-hmm. Divorce, as opposed to what happened in the Balkans after mm-hmm. the fall of the Yugoslav regime, where they basically had to fight their way to independence when independence could have just been the desired outcome from the beginning. The United States government was opposed, and all these NGOs, and it was just in the international consensus, they were all opposed to the Yugoslav republics going their separate way. It was amazing, even though it was obvious that this could only lead to bloodshed. They were absolutely ideologically opposed to this, and these republics had to fight their way to freedom when they could have just had a velvet divorce like the Czechs if the international community, and really only the United States, had to do this. If the United States had taken the lead on this, it would have been so liberating for those Balkan countries. So any opportunity of peaceful secession against globalization, against imperialism, I think is something that we should treasure, even if the impetus is coming from the left. And there are these terrible left-wing quote-unquote nationalist movements the reason why the left, the grifters, the opportunists, the parasites that they are, will actually try and use nationalism as a sock puppet for their own nefarious aims is because nationalism is a real force. And the right needs to get on board with this. And it's really a shame that a lot of, say, patriotic Englishmen identify with the United Kingdom, not with England. And they were filled with bile and scorn for the Scottish wanting to be independent. You know, who are you to want to be independent from us? That kind of attitude. That's very unfortunate.
Well, it's because they want to uphold institutions. The right wing, this is why I've been talking about this, because the European stage is a bit different. The right wing nationalist portions of Europe, whether it's Spain, United Kingdom, Italy, they believe, and it's because it's the paradigm that they've grown up in, it's the framework, it's the status quo that they're used to, they believe that to be a right-wing nationalist is to uphold the institution of the nation state, the monarchy, unification. That's the right-wing position. And I think that it's outdated and it's not fit for purpose for the problems that we're facing now. Because if your nation state is welcoming in untold numbers of racial foreigners to the point where the native population, your people, are now facing minority status forever, you won't get this reversed if things continue this way, then you have to start adopting different positions. And so I see secession movements and independence movements within the European stage as a way of combating globalization, combating replacement migration, and reclaiming sovereignty for an ethnos, for a people. And that's why I've been saying that the right has missed a trick here and needs to get its act together, because nationalism is a force, and because the institutions and the nation states that you know, we conservatives, we right wingers are brought up to want to uphold, well, they've betrayed us.
Yeah.
So we need to look beyond those institutions and beyond those paradigms. And that's why you get a lot of the Spanish, for in particular, this issue has really become more important to me living in Spain, because the Spanish nationalists in particular are so loath to the idea of any of the separatist movements in Spain, whether it's Catalonia, País Vasco, Galicia. They don't like this idea. They love the monarchy. They love the red, gold, and red flag. They wear bracelets on their wrists with those colors to show that they are Spanish nationalists in favor of being a united Spain, even though Spain really is quite disjointed, ununited, because the regions have so much autonomy, as it should be. And so my concern now is that as Spain is in the clutches of a increasingly neo-Bolshevik globalist regime, with neither the center-right providing any sort of resistance, in fact, they're often worse than the leftist socialist ruling party, Spanish nationalists need to, like, again, talk about principles, look at what is best for their people. And in the case of Spain, there are quite disparate peoples on the peninsula. Mm-hmm. And I think that the right, the nationalist right, is missing opportunities to reclaim sovereignty, preserve their traditions, preserve their languages and their customs and their kin, their national identity. But so often, you know, the status quo nationalist movements just want to keep supporting and upholding institutions and nation states and monarchies and things like that are no longer fit for purpose.
Absolutely. Another reason why I support secessionism is just as a form of political agitation. It drives globalists absolutely crazy. And they have meltdowns. They go into rampages. Watching Brexit unfold was a beautiful thing for me. I am almost entirely Anglo-Scottish in descent, going way, 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 way back, as long as we've got historical records. And I didn't realize how much of an Anglophile I was until Brexit actually went through and I got all teary-eyed listening to Land of Hope and Glory as it was announced that Britain was leaving the UK. Did I think that that would be a panacea? No, because the same mentality that inhabits the EU and makes it so poison was shared by the British establishment. But it was very educational watching the British establishment drag their feet on Brexit until basically Boris Johnson, because of his own short-term political interests, decided to run on finishing the process, and he won on that. That was the second Brexit referendum that the left were screaming for, and they lost that one too. But just the amount of tears and effort and angst that that created for the globalists and the internationalists is a good thing. I want these people, I want these people's spirits to break. I want these people to give up eventually because they're evil. And as long as they have breath and will, they are going to continue to do evil, and therefore they must be defeated, and to constantly batter them. There's an old saying that even if you don't need the milk, the cow needs to be milked, right? And that's true with your enemies. Even if you don't need a particular political victory, they need to be pummeled. and your side needs to be active, because if you're not active, you become passive. And if you're passive, then they're pummeling you. So we should always be looking for opportunities to overturn established orders, because the globalists infest established orders, and it's not going to break them, but it'll cause them a great deal of panic and consternation, and they're going to have to reform. So it's good to keep hitting them. It's just good to keep hitting these bastards. And I loved Brexit just for that, even though I was quite skeptical that it would change anything in terms of immigration, for instance. I thought that this was a good thing because it upset the establishment and it forced the establishment to work hard to get back in control, which eventually they did. They got back in control, sadly. But I think we should keep trying. And therefore, as soon I want Scottish independence. As soon as Brexit happened, I thought, okay, now it's time for the SNP to try and get out so they can get back into the EU. Anything to just keep the process churning along, because our people can insert themselves into that, agitate, and get our messages into those conversations. I think that's a good thing.
Oh, exactly. Totally agree.
Well, hey, I have really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. And I definitely would love to have you back in Countercurrents Radio.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I've had a great time talking to you as well.
All right. So this is definitely going to be the first of many conversations. Folks, we're having a somewhat irregular schedule for a while, but I will be back someday with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.